This is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, October 17th, 2007. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns. In today's program, Attorney General nominee Michael Mukasey begins confirmation hearings. Turkey's parliament votes to allow military action against Kurdish rebels in northern Iraq. And the Khalil Gibran International Academy's embattled ex-principal is reapplying for her position. All this and more, but first, these news headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with today's headlines. President Bush has tapped an opponent of birth control to lead the Family Planning Unit of the Department of Health and Human Services. Prior to her work in the department's Child Welfare Unit, Dr. Susan Orr was the senior director of the Marriage and Family Care Program at the Family Research Council, a Christian conservative think tank that promotes an abstinence-only approach to family planning. Her new appointment will put her in charge of a $283 million annual budget for family planning programs, reproductive health care, and counseling services. In other news, the ACLU and Senator Joseph Lieberman of Connecticut are taking on the Bureau of Immigration and Customs Enforcement over the forced drugging of deportees. Kelly Ramirez has the story.
ICE forcibly drugged 56 people prior to deportation between October of last year and April of this year, said ICE Chief Julie Myers in response to written questions from Senator Joseph Lieberman. Myers said 33 of those people were given drugs because of combative behavior. The ACLU of Southern California has filed a class action lawsuit to stop the practice. The suit's two named plaintiffs, a Christian minister from Indonesia and a Senegalese man who had a federal stay of his deportation, have denied combative behavior. They were injected with Haldol and Cogentin, psychotropic drugs that are not supposed to be used on subjects with no history of psychiatric illness. David Oakes, director of Mind Freedom International, a human rights organization for survivors of psychiatric treatment.
When the old Soviet Union drugged dissidents, it's very obvious to people there's a political violation, and that's the same case here, where you have someone whose only crime is allegedly that they're in the country illegally, and you're drugging them for the convenience of quieting them down. It's just obviously political.
ICE would not comment because of the pending litigation. For FSRN, I'm Kelia Ramirez.
The city of Vancouver says its police force will evict a group of about a dozen tent city squatters who are protesting the lack of affordable housing in the city. Zach Badorf has more from British Columbia.
The activists erected their tent Sunday on a patch of grass in between two buildings in Vancouver's downtown east side, an area of about 10 city blocks with about 2,000 homeless Canadians. 30% of the area's population has HIV, the highest infection rate in North America. The group is squatting on city property allotted for social housing. But the squatters say it's past time for the city to build housing for the homeless or those at risk of living on the streets. So the Streams of Justice organization is taking the issue to court on the same day the city police plan on evicting the squatters. The civic group will ask the British Columbia Supreme Court to allow the homeless of Vancouver to occupy the property indefinitely. On a visit to Canada for Homelessness Action Week, the UN envoy on homelessness says Vancouver should take the opportunity of the upcoming Olympics here in 2010 to close the striking gap between the rich and the poor in the city. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Zach Badorf in Vancouver.
Pakistan's Supreme Court today began hearing post-electoral challenges to the candidacy of President Pervez Musharraf. Provincial councils and local lawmakers earlier this month re-elected Musharraf to another term in office. However, Musharraf cannot declare victory until the Supreme Court rules on if he was eligible to run in the first place. The Musharraf camp has been holding talks with former Prime Minister Benazir Bhutto about a possible power-sharing agreement. Bhutto has announced that she will return to Pakistan from self-imposed exile tomorrow. And finally, farmers in India have announced plans to launch a nationwide campaign to highlight the country's agrarian crisis. Bismila Gilani reports.
A national meeting of the Indian Farmers Union concluded yesterday in New Delhi with a resolution to step up pressure on the government to help resolve the crisis in the countryside. The farmers are demanding full debt relief for outstanding farm loans and higher market prices for their produce. They also want the government to pull out of the World Trade Organization and reverse the special economic zone policy. The farmers say the government of India has failed to force the United States and the European Union to scale down their farm subsidies, reduce their import tariffs, and stop dumping subsidized agriculture commodities onto Indian markets. The campaign will focus on the states of Punjab, Haryana, Uttar Pradesh, Maharashtra, Rajasthan, and Madhya Pradesh, where an estimated 150,000 farmers have committed suicide in the last 5 years due to economic collapse. For FSRN, this is Bismillah Gilani from New Delhi.
And those are today's headlines. I'm Shannon Young.
The House of Representatives is supposed to vote on a new plan for electronic surveillance today, but the outcome is suddenly unexpected as Democrats are pulling their support. The legislation reverses some surveillance powers given to the president in August, but it expands the government's ability to wiretap. FSRN's Leanne Caldwell reports.
Democrats struggled to maintain support for their surveillance legislation known as the Restore Act. Some lawmakers are second-guessing their support. Some moderate Democrats might oppose it because they wanted telecommunication companies to have immunity for allegedly handing over their customers' records to the government in the name of national security. Then some progressive Democrats feel the bill doesn't protect civil liberties, including Representative Rush Holt, Democrat of New Jersey, who plans to oppose it.
Those who have written the bill with the best of intentions say that they are providing a bill that will protect the security of Americans and the liberties of Americans. And they've done the former well, they've done the latter only partially. And I guess the way I would describe it is that there is a large segment, there's a large category of Americans who would be subject to surveillance, in other words, spying, without the protection of the court.
Representative Holt says a warrant should be sought of Americans before any wiretapping begins. The Restore Act allows wiretapping of Americans located inside the United States for 15 days before they must prove the person is deemed suspicious. But House Speaker Nancy Pelosi is defending the legislation, saying it strikes the right balance between civil liberties and security.
The legislation restores checks and balances in other ways. It rejects groundless claims of inherent executive authority. Under that, we might as well just crown the president king and just say he has access to any information in our country and he may collect that outside the law.
Meanwhile, Republicans would accept nothing less than the Bush administration written legislation that passed in August. It gave the executive branch broad powers to wiretap with little or no oversight. Representative Peter Hoekstra, ranking Republican of the Intelligence Committee.
Rather than working towards speed and flexibility and making sure that we give our intelligence professionals the tools that they need, we're finding, number one, that we're providing more tools and more protections to the people that we are trying to defeat.
Civil liberties advocates are also split in their opinion. Kate Martin, director of the Center for National Security Studies, says this legislation could do more to provide protections. Despite that, her group is standing behind it.
We believe that the Restore Act is actually a substantial improvement over current law, which is the Protect America Act, so-called, that was passed in August. And it takes important steps towards restoring constitutional protections.
But the American Civil Liberties Union is maintaining their opposition. Michelle Richardson with the ACLU says Americans' privacy is undermined.
It does improve upon the Protect America Act, but we feel that it just fundamentally does not meet Fourth Amendment muster because it doesn't require warrants, individualized warrants, for Americans who are being wiretapped on American soil.
Representative Holt of New Jersey addresses concerns of some Democrats who are supporting the Restore Act for fear that alternative legislation could offer less protections.
Well, it's always possible that Congress can go farther and do worse. We have from time to time. But that's no reason. I mean, at least that's not reason enough for me to bring myself to vote for something that I think is not only unconstitutional, but in fact, does not make us safer.
A last-minute addition to the legislation can be interpreted to mean that any person in the United States who is undocumented, and even with legal temporary status such as visa holders, can be wiretapped without a warrant. Democratic leaders are hoping to pass the legislation and send it to the Senate. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
From habeas corpus to warrantless wiretapping, and from the firing of federal prosecutors to low Justice Department morale, the Senate Judiciary Committee held a confirmation hearing for Michael Mukasey today. He's the judge who could become the next Attorney General. Karen Miller has more from Washington, D.C.
With recent outbursts at past hearings with former Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez, at today's hearing with Mukasey, Chairman of the Committee Senator Patrick Leahy laid out the ground rules before the hearing began.
If there are any demonstrations either for or against a position that any witness might take, that person will be removed.
After Mukasey took an oath before the committee to tell the truth, committee members came with a laundry list of questions they wanted to ask. At the top of the list, Mukasey's views on torture.
Do you believe that the president has the authority under any circumstances to exercise a so-called commander-in-chief override and immunize acts of torture?
We are parties to a treaty that outlaws torture. Torture is unlawful under the laws of this country. But beyond all of those legal restrictions, we don't torture not simply because it's against this or that law or against this or that treaty. It is not what this country is about.
That was Mukasey being questioned by Senator Patrick Leahy, Democrat from Connecticut. Mukasey said the statutes that allow torture under former Attorney General Gonzalez were against the law in the first place. Democrats and other civil rights groups have strongly opposed the president's use of executive power to erode civil liberties. But at the hearing today, it was a Republican who asked if Mukasey would toe the line. Senator Arlen Specter of Pennsylvania.
Are you prepared to resign if the president were to violate your advice and your view violate the Constitution of the United States?
If the president proposed to undertake a course of conduct that was in violation of the Constitution, that would present me with a difficult but not a complex problem. I would have two choices. I could either try to talk him out of it or leave. Those are the choices.
Well, if the alternative is to leave, if you can't talk him out of it, then I think the answer to my question is yes.
It is.
Senator Patrick Leahy said one main issue at hand was a public trust.
This crisis has taken a heavy toll in morale at the department and in confidence among the American people. I know that the dismay runs deep from the career attorneys at justice and in our U.S. attorneys' offices straight down to the police officer on the beat.
When asked about Guantanamo, Mukasey said it would most likely stay open.
I can't simply say we have to close Guantanamo because obviously the question then arises of what we do with the people who were there, and there is now no easy solution to that.
On wireless wiretapping, Mukasey was vague on his answer, saying there was a gap in what the president could do and what the Constitution permitted. Democrats and Republicans say Mukasey will most likely be confirmed. For Free Speech Radio News in Washington, D.C., I'm Karen Miller.
Se baila así, se goza más.
A resolution labeling the Ottoman Empire's killing of 1.5 million Armenians 100 years ago a genocide is losing support in the U.S. Congress. Many initial backers of the resolution are pulling their support because of the negative diplomatic reaction of Turkey. The country is a strategic base for the United States. Meanwhile, tensions are simmering on the border between Turkey and Kurdish Iraq. Today, the Turkish parliament overwhelmingly voted to authorize military action against the Kurdistan Workers' Party, or PKK, in northern Iraq. But with diplomatic pressure from the United States, NATO, and Iraq not to move forward with military action, some doubt an actual strike will happen. For more analysis of this issue, FSRN spoke with Lehigh University professor Henri Barkey. He has been studying the conflict between Turkey and the Kurds since the late 90s. I asked Professor Barkey about the Kurdistan Workers' Party's presence in northern Iraq.
Yes, there's a PKK presence in northern Iraq, unquestionably, and it's a fairly sizable one. But there's also a lot of PKK fighters in Turkey itself. So the problem is not just in northern Iraq. Arms come from northern Iraq, but in the past they've come through Iran as well, and they can also be obtained locally in Turkey. So it's not purely a northern Iraq problem, but to some extent for both the Turkish government and the Turkish military, putting the blame on northern Iraq is easier than saying we have to deal with our problems at home. And finally, I should also point out that part of the reason the Turks are so up in arms about northern Iraq is because they are really afraid that as a result of the chaos that we see in Iraq today, that Iraq one day will split up into different areas, and that one of them will be Kurdistan. And they think that Kurdish independent Kurdish state in northern Iraq would be a beacon for Kurds all over the region.
Do you think at this point, I mean, the Turkish parliament has now overwhelmingly voted to allow the attacks, to authorize the attacks, doesn't necessarily mean they're actually going to go through with it. Do you think it's wise politically for Turkey to cross into Iraq?
To be perfectly honest, the Turks are not able to mount a major cross-border operation with lots of armored vehicles, tanks, etc., because that would involve them in a major, major fight with Iraqi Kurds, and that would draw them into a quagmire that they would never be able to get out. They know that. They're not about to do that. What they would do probably is limited airstrikes with some helicopter-borne attack, commando attacks. That's all they can do because the border doesn't allow you to bring large quantities of armored vehicles. There's only one crossing point where you can bring in tanks and armored vehicles, and that's controlled by the Iraqi Kurds. And the Iraqi Kurds are not about to let Turks come in large numbers. That said, even these things would have to happen with the accordance of the United States, because we control the airspace of northern Iraq.
And at this point, the United States is saying no.
The United States and even the Iraqi Kurds, and the Iraqi Kurds have told me this, would probably say yes to a limited operation. And by limited, they probably mean a one-time attack to very specific targets so that there are no casualties among Kurdish civilians in northern Iraq. That they will say yes to. But the issue, unfortunately, is that probably the Turks will want to have almost a carte blanche, to be able to go in whenever they feel like it and whenever they want. And that is unacceptable to both the United States and Iraqi Kurds. And I think that's what the issue is at the moment. The United States, I think, understands that the Turkish government is under enormous pressure from both its domestic public, the opposition, and the military to do something. And since this Turkish government, in many respects, is the best government Turkey has had in a long, long time, the United States does not or would not want to see this government undermined by either the military or the opposition. So if I was a decision maker in Washington, my inclination would be to come to some kind of agreement with Iraqi Kurds and the Turks for some operation that will allow the Turkish government to say, you see, we did it. But it may not result in this because the Turks may insist on having a much bigger operation, and that's very risky for the United States because it may undermine and destabilize the only place in Iraq where, A, we don't have really troops there because this is the one place where nobody attacks us, nobody objects to our presence, and it is the only stable part of Iraq.
Henri Barkey is professor of international affairs at Lehigh University. U.S. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice is meeting again in 2 days with Palestinian and Israeli officials. It's a bid to bridge the gap between the two sides and come up with a joint statement on key negotiation points, such as questions over Palestinian refugees, Jewish settlements, and the accessibility of holy sites. Rice's visit to the region comes ahead of a Washington-sponsored conference on Middle East peace next month. FSRN's Rami Almagari has more from Gaza City.
In the West Bank city of Ramallah, Rice met with Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas with no press briefing this time. As sources close to the meeting expressed skepticism over Rice's success to secure an Israeli agreement to that document. Saeb Erekat is a senior Palestinian negotiator.
I cannot say that there are specifically clear-cut Israeli positions, especially after we had two meetings with the Israeli side.
Wire services reported that Rice had asked President Abbas to cancel a previous demand that both parties set a specific timetable for any post-conference Israeli-Palestinian talks and to drop the issue of Palestinian refugees from the conference agenda. In this excerpt from Al Jazeera's Insider story aired on Monday, Gerald Stenberg from Bar-Ilan University in Jerusalem says if there is to be an agreement, then there has to be movement on the Palestinian side on key issues.
The issue of refugee claims and accepting a two-state solution and not trying to rewrite the history of the Arab invasion and rejectionism all the way back to 47. If that doesn't happen, there just is nothing to talk about. The Israeli public will absolutely reject that.
Hani Habib is a political analyst in Gaza.
Success of this conference for the Palestinian leadership lies in the resumption of negotiations. The Palestinian leaders have realized over the past 7-year-long peace process stalemate that Israel had accelerated settlement expansion, constructed the separation barrier, and annexed large parts of East Jerusalem to West Jerusalem.
In West Jerusalem, Secretary Rice will meet later in the day with Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert, who had earlier expressed his rejection to a joint statement. The Washington-sponsored conference will likely be held in Annapolis, Maryland, late in November. For Free Speech Radio News and IMEMC.org, this is Rami Almighari in Gaza.
The Khalil Gibran International Academy is the first public bilingual middle school in New York City dedicated to educating children about Arab history, culture, and language. Before the academy opened its doors this fall, the school and its founding principal, Debbie Almontasser, came under fire by right-wing bloggers and corporate media who said the school was a breeding ground for Islamist terrorists. As a result, Almontasser was forced to resign immediately before the school opened. But yesterday, Almontasser, amid strong public support, announced that she will reapply for the principal position. Andalusia Knoll reports from New York City.
After a forced resignation earlier this summer, Debbie Almontasser, the founder of Khalil Gibran International Academy, announced that she will reapply to be principal of the school. At a press conference at City Hall, Debbie Almontasser stated that the media campaigns that led to her forced resignation have wide implications.
While I have been a victim of a serious injustice, the far larger offense here has been to the Arab and Muslim communities of New York City. In the years since September 11th, our communities have been the object of the most vile and hateful attacks. The attacks on me are part of a larger campaign to intimidate and silence marginalized communities.
Days after the Department of Education announced the establishment of the Khalil Gibran International Academy in February of 2007, right-wing bloggers like Daniel Pipes began spinning the secular academy as an Islamist school with a radical extremist jihad principle. Numerous New York City newspapers ran inflammatory headlines like Holy War, Slow Parents Protest Arabic School Plan, and Arabic school idea is a monstrosity. Amidst these media attacks on the academy, Debbie Almontasser had been asked by the New York Post what she thought of t-shirts that said New York City Intifada that were made by an Arab women's art collective, when she explained that the Arabic word Intifada means shake off and doesn't promote a, quote, Gaza-style uprising in New York City. She was told that the school would be closed if she did not resign. A new principal who is Jewish and does not speak Arabic filled her position. Letitia James, a city council member in the Brooklyn neighborhood where the Khalil Gibran Academy is located, says that dialogue about the meaning of words like intifada is exactly what needs to happen in schools.
We have to break down all of the stereotypes. We have to break down all of the ignorance. We have to shed to the light, to the sunshine, all that Debbie and the Arab community has to offer our community. Is this not a city of diversity and tolerance? Or is this a city of hate?
At yesterday's press conference, various New York-based rabbis, imams, parents, and other community members spoke in support of Debbie Almontaser as she expressed the need for cross-cultural understanding.
I stand here today to say that they will not prevail. I will continue to stand against division, intimidation, and hatred. I will stand for a society based on mutual respect and understanding and dignity for all communities.
While they await to see if Debbie Almontaser's principal application is accepted, the school supporters are seeking an investigation into the handling of the affair by the school district and the mayor's office. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Andalusia Null in New York City.
And now, from his cell on Pennsylvania death row, a commentary from Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Beat camp. A 14-year-old boy is assaulted, restrained, his breathing restricted, and ammonia capsules are plunged into his nostrils as he struggles for breath. Within moments, he falls limp, comatose. Soon, Martin Lee Anderson is dead. Martin met his death at a Florida boot camp, where a phalanx of so-called drill instructors beat the youth, held their hands over his mouth, and forced ammonia caps up his nose. A predominantly white jury quickly acquitted all 8 staff members, including a nurse, from the boot camp of all charges. The state workers would have faced more punishment if they killed a dog. Instead, he was a black boy. The jury barely had enough time for a good lunch. Across the nation, families are learning that boot camps and other juvenile facilities are little more than hellholes for children. Kids are beaten, brutalized, starved, and caged by the state, paid by the state to administer legalized child abuse. Schools, especially in black and Latino neighborhoods, are increasingly training grounds for failure. Also, with the popular pollution of culture, there is the spread of the worst, most anti-life and misogynist ideas imaginable, usually through music. Cut off from the academic life of the nation, this cultural pollution seeks to justify various forms of street hustling as the only way of survival. Again, we see evidence of the war against youth. It's almost as if the generation of elders are envious of the very quality of youth and are utilizing state power to destroy them. Deindustrialization, state militarization, the failure of education, and cultural pollution are stages in this pervasive war. The reincarceration of Michael Bell, the recently released member of the Gina Six, is a part of this ongoing war. Children aren't children. They're merely young combatants who should be terrorized just like their elders. Unfortunately, I predicted the outcome in Florida to other guys here on death row. I'm sorry that I was right. From death row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are produced by Noel Hanrahan for Prison Radio.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. Our newscast is supported by Pacifica Radio, community radio affiliate stations, and listener supporters. We podcast at www.fsrn.org. That's fsrn.org. You can email us your feedback, questions, and story ideas to comments at fsrn.org. Today's newscast was produced by Monica Lopez and Jackson Allers. Headlines editor, Shannon Young. DC editor, Leanne Caldwell. And the technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley, Antonio Ortiz, Eric Klein, Puck Lowe, and Rose Kitabji. I'm Jess Burns in Eugene, Oregon.